Prabhupada. Welcome to you, sir. And I haven't got a name yet from Itasa. I'm sorry, but I think I'll soon get it now. You, both of you, you're very welcome. And thank you very much for coming from Mr. Bailey. Am I right? Am I pronouncing correctly now? Okay. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, it has now become a tradition that whenever the minister has presented the MTBTS or a budget, it's not only us who look at the budget. The whole country has an interest in the budget on issues whether it is addressing the objectives and the imperatives of government. We invite civil society, from business, trade unionists, everyone. Today, we will be hearing from the perspective of the business. Mr. Losha is going to address us from Sana. Mr. Losha, we are in your hands. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay. As you will notice there from the title of my short presentation that I'll do this morning is that I regard this year as unfortunately nothing less than a fiscal calamity. The fact of the matter is that our public finances deteriorated very substantially this year, and I'll illustrate that to you just now. I will illustrate to you just now to what extent actually we've lost 15 years of progress almost within the matter of 1 year. It means that the fiscal space has been closed down, unfortunately, and at a very inopportune moment in time, with the new administration coming in April, expected to deliver on decisions that were taken at previously at Polokwane. But the fact of the matter is that the whole economic background and fiscal background compared to December 2007 is now in December 2009 completely different. And therefore, one should see the medium-term budget policy statement, to my mind, to a large extent, from the perspective of how do you manage such a calamity. Now, just to illustrate that to you, I've compared this year specifically with the 1992-93 fiscal year. The reason being that in 92 we were also in a recession, just as now. Actually very similar. The economy contracted by about 2% in 1992, and the expected contraction for this year, the decline in GDP, is also expected to be roughly 2%. So in that sense, they are comparable years. And as you can see, if you look at the numbers there, as I said, in a certain sense, we're back to square one. We have a similar budget deficit compared to what we had in 92-93. The level of government debt, in terms of the interest-bearing debt at the moment, is still lower than what we had in 92-93. But one should, of course, add the contingent liabilities that comes from, for example, the guarantees that government has given to ESCOM on each debt, and that will raise that 29% to very close to 40% in any case, and then, of course, with the expectation that it will increase further. The public sector borrowing requirement this year is about 3 percentage points higher, actually, than in 92-93. Now, one can say that that is fine because it's mostly as a result of the infrastructure spending and with the other public corporations also involved there, so that's not the biggest headache. The real bond yield is now 2.7% compared to barely positive in 1993. In other words, the cost for government of taking on debt is now just that much higher than what it was in the previous recession. And then if you look at government expenditure and also government revenue, you'll see both those to variables as a percentage of GDP being substantially higher than what they were in 1993. In other words, the base from which we start is completely different also in terms of therefore allowing government to play a bigger role in the economy to counter the recession. You can see that compared to what we had in 1992-1993, you start from a much higher level, giving you much less room also then from which to operate. So in a certain sense, therefore, what this already tells us that in the next few years, unfortunately, the focus will have to be on getting our parameters back to where we would have liked them to have been if it wasn't for the recession. The deterioration that we had in 2009, I think it's extremely sharp. Tax revenue declining by more than 6% compared to the previous fiscal year, in spite of the recession being relatively moderate. Now, I don't want to get into trouble for making that statement, but perhaps I should explain. I don't mean by that one should take, for example, the job losses lightly. But what I mean by that is if you compare this recession to the previous one in the early 1990s, the decline from peak to trough in the GDP is going to be much smaller. It'll probably be roughly about half of the decline that we had at that point in time. Also in terms of the duration of the recession, the number of quarters of negative growth, this time around we will probably have three, at most four quarters of negative growth. Whereas in the early 1990s also it was double in terms of quarters of negative growth. So in that sense, in terms of the macro numbers, it is a relatively moderate recession. I think what has happened is that the changes that we've seen over the last, let's say, 10 odd years in the contribution of various types of taxes to government revenue is that tax revenue has become more cyclical, meaning in other words that a downturn in the economy, a recession, will have a proportionately bigger impact on revenue. But on the positive side, I think perhaps that one should also just bear in mind, perhaps it also means, in other words, that when the economy recovers, the tax revenue will also recover more rapidly as a result of it being more closely tied to the level of economic activity. Now, just to illustrate that point to you, again, comparing this current fiscal year to 92-93, GDP growth, as I said, roughly the same decline. The change in tax revenue as a percentage of GDP, this time around a much bigger fall, 2.5 percentage points compared to about 1 in 92-93. The change in government expenditure also being higher, the deterioration in the budget deficit therefore being bigger. And then those last two lines there, the contribution of personal income tax is now considerably lower than it was in 92-93. And the contribution of corporate taxes, on the other hand, that has increased from about 19% then to 29%. And corporate taxes, of course, are much more closely tied to the level of economic activity because corporate profits are much more closely tied to the economic cycle than the total wage bill, the total level of compensation for employees in the economy. In other words, personal income tax, it was a relatively stable component that the contribution of that came down, whereas the contribution of corporate taxes that are more cyclical, that has increased. And I just want to point out, as far as corporate taxes are concerned, that the nominal corporate tax rate, the tax rate of course, that has declined quite substantially in the past 10 odd years. But in spite of that, if you look at the total amount of tax paid by corporate income tax, and you take that as a percentage of the gross operating surplus. Now the gross operating surplus is sort of the macroeconomic equivalent for the total amount of profits that the corporate sector make. Then you see that percentage increases. It's stabilized in the last, say, 3 years, but it's increased over this whole period. In other words, in spite of the nominal corporate tax rate being reduced, the effective rate must have increased to give you this result. And if the effective rate increases, it also means you get a closer relationship between the amount of tax that corporates will pay and the business cycle. So as I said, at this point in time, it impacted negatively on us. Hopefully, now going forward, as the economy starts to recover, it will work in our favor with tax, the tax rate recovering a bit more more rapidly. Apart from tax revenue, if you look at the expenditure side, of course, expenditure now increasing in nominal terms by 17.6% versus last year. At the time of the budget, it was that number was projected to be at more than 15%, so it's about an extra 2% that's been added. The fact is that if you look at the overspend, it's actually, I think, quite well controlled. It's not that very high. But what is a bit of a concern is that of the 14 billion on a net basis in extra expenditure, 12 of that 14 billion is accounted for by the above average increase that we've seen in government's wage and salary bill. And I find it quite striking that if you look at the medium-term budget policy statement, there's a number of references to this issue, that unfortunately the fact that the wage increases were higher than what was budgeted for, it has long-term consequences, because that, of course, is not, it's not a one-off. It means it gets built into your wage bill and into government expenditure every year in going into the future. Actually, if you look at the period over which the medium-term budget policy statement stretches, then the above budget increases in the wage bill adds 2% of GDP to the total government debt level over that period. So I don't know exactly how government is going to do it, but I think that will unfortunately have to be one of the focus points going forward, is to get a better handle on the total wage bill. The deficit then in the end, 7.6% versus 1% last year, as you know, government debt increasing, and unfortunately with increased debt comes, of course, increased cost of debt also, higher interest payments, that will constrain room as far as the discretionary spending is concerned. I just want to highlight this aspect to you. At the moment, in terms of what's happening globally, it's almost as though it's quite acceptable to increase your debt-to-GDP ratios. Nobody will really criticize any country for doing that. And that is fine, but it has consequences. And what I've highlighted in this graph in particular is the relationship between the government's government debt-to-GDP, that ratio, that's the red columns that you see there. And then the blue line is the real yield on government bonds. And you can see that strong relationship. And in the, specifically here since 1999, 2000, the past 10 years, we've had a substantial decline in the debt-to-GDP ratio. That has made it possible that real bond yields could decline quite substantially. That means you reduce the cost of capital in the economy. And that was, I think, one of the driving factors behind the very good growth that we had from 2004 to 2007 specifically. So if we're now heading in the opposite direction with the debt-to-GDP ratio in 2012-13, according to budget, going to be above 41%, but as I'll show you a bit later on, we must expect it to continue increasing after that. So if you go back towards 50%, where we were 10 years ago, it implies you're going to have higher real long-term interest rates, which means that you're going to have lower economic growth. That is the, unfortunately, the side, the impact that will have on the economy. The medium-term outlook for revenue, I think for a start, one must say that in dealing with this recession, in managing this calamity, as I've called it, one should not over-respond. We have a bit of time on our side, but we must have our plans in place as to how, once we've used up that time, how we're going to deal with the issue. The macroeconomic assumptions in the budget is, I think, quite conservative. The growth rate for next year, for example, the government is projecting is at 1.5%. It's substantially lower than the consensus view of about 2.5%. Now, in taking that more conservative stance, the National Treasury highlights the fact that the global prospects are uncertain, and I agree with them. The global prospects are certainly very, very uncertain, and I think we can still have quite a bumpy road ahead of us. But the single most important reason for the low growth forecast from the Treasury is that they take a much more dim view of a recovery in household consumption expenditure than what the consensus view in the private sector would do. They have growth in household consumption expenditure next year of only 0.9%, whereas I think mostly you will find an assumption of about 3% growth in household consumption in other forecasts. They tend to emphasize the debt hangover, which is once again is quite correct. We still have a quite high debt to disposable income ratio that constrains household expenditure. But perhaps what they underestimate is the improvement that we are going to see in disposable income going into next year. So it's those two factors that will play off one against the other. Hopefully we get a better outcome than the 1.5%. Which means that the revenue will then recover more quickly and the fiscal numbers will improve more quickly. The debt to GDP ratio, as I said, will unfortunately continue to rise. Now, just to illustrate that, the issue of fiscal sustainability, in other words, of stabilizing that debt level, the number to look at there is the primary deficit. Now, the primary deficit is, of course, if you take government expenditure excluding the cost of state debt, and you subtract that from the revenue side. Now, if the primary balance is in a deficit, is negative, the implication is, in other words, you're borrowing money to pay interest. And I think from your personal finances, you will all know that that's not a good idea. It means your debt will keep on rising as long as you borrow money to pay interest. You don't pay down your debt. But secondly also, what it also implies is the interest rate that you pay on that debt. If the interest rate is higher than the growth rate in GDP, it means that the debt to GDP ratio will continue to increase. Now, what I've done in that table, in the second column for the 4 years in question, I've noted the actual primary deficit. And then in the right-hand column, I calculated what it should have been just to stabilize the debt at the previous year's level. In other words, years from 2010-11 down to 2012-13, I don't try to bring us back to the debt levels that we have now, but just to stabilize it where it was in the previous year. And you can see what's required from us at the moment is actually fiscal surpluses, primary surpluses, and whereas right through the period it remains negative. So, in other words, that implies the debt to GDP ratio is going to continue rising beyond that 41% that's projected there in the medium-term budget policy statement. And if you specifically then also take into account the contingent liabilities that I referred to earlier, we are heading back to 50% plus. Unfortunately. Now, just going back, I just want to make a point that therefore against this background there is pressure that therefore you should look at taxes. Should you not increase taxes? But the fact of the matter is that our tax burden is already quite high. And in that sense, I don't think there's really room to increase the tax burden further. According to the 2007 World Bank Development Indicators, for 2007, South Africa's consolidated tax to GDP percentage was 32%, and for middle income countries, which is the group into which we fall, the average is 18.2. So we're already a highly taxed economy, a highly taxed country, And I don't think there's really room for increasing the tax burden any further. In any case, in our case, it's politically very difficult to increase some taxes such as VAT. The only taxes that you could increase could be, for example, corporate tax. But if you increase the corporate tax rate in conjunction with an increase in real long-term interest rates that I referred to earlier, it just means that you're going to have less investment and therefore lower growth in the economy. And likewise for individuals, if you want to get 1% of GDP more in tax from individuals, taxpayers as a whole, you have to increase the average tax rate by 10%. If you say that, okay, we're going to not raise tax on the lower income groups, then of course, if you raise it only on the higher income groups, it has to be increased that just that much more. But calculated, for example, if you limit the increase to people earning more than 300,000 rand a year in taxable income, you will have to increase the average tax rate for them by 25%. Just to get 1% of GDP more in terms of tax, and that is clearly not feasible. So that's why I'm saying I don't think the emphasis should be on increasing taxes. We should try to avoid tax increases. The implication therefore being that you have to look at expenditure. The expenditure, I can see in the medium-term budget policy statement, there is a serious attempt at good discipline, but nevertheless the improvement if you look at the expenditure to GDP ratio, is very, very slow. Actually, you need to reduce it more aggressively. Our expenditure to GDP ratio is 30.1% compared to 18.6% for the average middle-income countries. So there's a real challenge here ahead. I think for a start, any new programs, you can't just add on expenditure. You have to redefine priorities. If you want to add something new, you have to take away that money from somewhere else in order to be able to afford that. The fact of the matter is that we are unusual, that for our stage of development, we've gone the route of more or less a European kind of welfare state. So social protection equals already 14% of consolidated expenditure, and that puts restrictions on us in terms of that can't really be reduced. So greater efficiency and effectiveness in public expenditure is non-negotiable. We can't avoid it. And one thing I just want to point out is that the compensation of employees now equals 57% of government's current payments. And once again, if you say that that's untouchable, you can't actually retrench people from the civil service. That would be rather bizarre for government to do that. It just means, once again, there's a large component of expenditure that's fixed, and it's only a small portion left then that you can work with to try and save. I'll ask just finally a few words on macroeconomic policy. The medium-term budget policy statement refers specifically to inflation targeting. I think it's very welcome that if I read the statement and the minister's speech correctly, that it's quite clear responsibility for whether we have inflation targeting or not and what shape it takes remains with the National Treasury. But what's quite clear from the statement is that the Minister favours a reasoned approach. He acknowledges the complexities. I think he also acknowledges that it is also necessary to engage with critics of inflation targeting. Of course, but then on a rational basis. I find the reference there to the discussion that the Minister had with the Reserve Bank, both the outgoing and the incoming governors, that they will take growth also into account. I find that in line with the Reserve Bank's approach already of being flexible in how they're approaching inflation targeting. The Reserve Bank has been fond of saying that they're not inflation nutters. They are flexible inflation targeters. And I think we've seen it being demonstrated this year par excellence that in spite of inflation coming down very slowly, they were ignored that slow trend in favor of taking the real economy into account. The commitment to low inflation remains. I think that's really welcome. That is just a fundamental macroeconomic requirement for any economy. The Minister is quite correct in pointing out that there is an international debate about whether about inflation targeting, whether inflation targeting is such a good thing or not. But I just want to point out that there are differences, important differences between the international debate and the debate that we have here. The international debate is about whether financial stability should be added as a monetary policy objective, not whether growth should be added as a monetary policy objective. So the debate internationally is about interest rates being too low at one stage, whereas in our case the argument is that our interest rates have been too high. If you were to take the international debate and apply that to South Africa, then the question that you would be asking actually is, if you look at that graph, in 2004 going through to 2006, whether the Reserve Bank didn't lower interest rates by too much, whether our interest rates also didn't go perhaps to too low a level by 2006 against the background of an exploding household debt level, therefore facilitating, or I can say encouraging, the increase in debt, which is now constraining us. And if I refer back to the debt hangover that's been identified also by the Treasury. So that is really what one should ask. But if I can just summarize in one sentence, I think the objective of monetary policy must remain low and stable inflation. How we achieve that, and what way, using what regime, that can be debated, certainly. Then, second last issue, that briefly, the value of the rand. I think it's clear the rand is overvalued. That's the consensus view in the private sector also. But intervention is not the answer. Intervention, I think, will be way too expensive. If you look at the level of trading in the rand, it's $13 billion trading in the rand foreign exchange market every day. You will have to have very deep pockets if you want to influence on a daily basis the trend in the rand by way of intervention. I think in any case, in terms of gaining a competitive edge against your competitors internationally, the issue is greater productivity. The issue is not a depreciating currency. That's not the way to go. The important thing is perhaps rather to reduce volatility, making business decisions and business planning easier, and that the relaxation of exchange controls that were announced certainly will contribute to that. It encourages greater two-way trade. It's always bothered me that we have liberalized exchange control in a skewed manner. Right at the start, we liberalized controls on foreigners completely. We removed them completely. Whereas on the other hand, on local residents, we still kept them in place, and we've only gradually lowered the barriers. Now, the point is, therefore, you have an unbalanced situation. That foreigners can buy and sell the rand as they please on a minute-by-minute basis, one can almost say, if you think in terms of the trading desk of the big international banks, whereas residents are, in terms of their flows, it has to follow a very prescribed path. So that has contributed, to my mind, to volatility, and these changes will help to reduce volatility. But I want to point out, exchange and volatility is, I think, it's linked to the fact that the rand is excessively liquid. I don't know how exactly we're going to get that back under control. I think the level of trading in the rand is unnecessarily high. If we compare us to China, for example, the level of trading in the rand is double that in the Chinese renminbi, in spite of them being a much bigger economy than ours. If you compare us to Brazil, then our level of trading is almost four times that of the Brazilian real. And I think that needs to be looked at a micro level. And then there's the volatility in commodity prices. Commodity prices have become much more volatile. And the rand being a commodity currency, traded as a commodity currency, the rand has become more volatile. But you see the same trend, for example, if you were to look at the Australian dollar, that's also a commodity currency. You see also an increased volatility there. So I think We have to explore other options. One option that's been used successfully by some countries is to have a commodity stabilization fund. Norway has done it. Chile has done it quite successfully. The oil producing countries have recently, when the oil price spiked so high, many of them moved in that direction. So that in other words, when you have a commodity boom, you don't allow all the dollars to flow into the country to strengthen the currency. You keep some of it offshore, and when things go against you, then you release and release some of that again. But it's a complicated exercise. It can also cost you if it's not managed properly. But I should think that's the kind of thing, rather, that we can still look at. And then finally, Chair, just on economic growth, I think it's been said now for various quarters that we need a new, more leader-driven growth strategy. If I look at the medium-term budget policy statement, then I don't see a comprehensive, cohesive strategy there. I rather see a collection of loose comments which are valid on their own. It's a combination of some ideas from the past and searching for new ideas. I assume that it's a matter of it's a work in progress, that the new administration still has to finalize its growth strategy. And I look forward to seeing then in the end what that would look like once we have clarity. But macroeconomic stability is foundational. You can't compromise on that. I think we must recognize we've chosen the social democratic developmental state as a model for our economy. It's a difficult model within which to manage growth to a higher level. But I think if we focus on the basics and get them right, for example, in education, that already will help quite a lot. Unfortunately, government debt saving has returned. That implies it's negative implications for your balance of payments, for example. It implies that just on its own, taken on its own, it means a higher deficit on the current account. Or if you look at it in a different way, it means that specifically the corporate sector will have to save more to compensate for that. And in the end, if you want to encourage growth, then we have to cut back on spending and taxes. And just the last slide is just a summary. Some worrying things that I think we just need to keep an eye on. The increase in expenditure to GDP, increase in the tax burden, debt to GDP ratio, the debt cost, the upward pressure on long-term interest rates, government debt saving, and then finalizing the macroeconomic policy. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lotzer. I know that other economists are very interested in engaging you in what you have raised. And let's open now that opportunity now for members to raise questions. Honorable Dr. George. Honorable Ramasadana, Honorable Suwede, Honorable Mashim, Khosh Mashim.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Mr. Lapsha, for a very interesting presentation. On slide number 3, and you don't have numbers on your slide, but I made some numbers, so I hope they're the same as yours. You talk about the fiscal deterioration in 2009 being extremely sharp, and then you're talking about the cyclicality of the tax revenue. Now, my understanding is that tax revenue is always affected by the business cycle, so, you know, there is that cyclicality anyway, but why is it more? And then, on page number 10, number 10, the outlook for expenditure. You mentioned the non-contributing expenditure. Yes, that's the one. On bullet point number 4, you mentioned the welfare state, etc. Are you saying that we should cut spending on social security? Our view is that it shouldn't be cut, but your opinion would be valued. Then on the final bullet was, you're talking about public expenditure on the compensation for employees, about 57%, which is on the high side. What would be a more manageable number? And then finally, a statement rather than a question on slide number 14 on macroeconomic policy. On point number 6, you talk about the developmental state being a difficult model. I think you're being extremely kind. This model requires a very efficient and capable state, something that we actually do not have. So it's much more than a difficult model. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Professor. Honourable Ramatagan. Honourable.
Thank you, Chair. My question is in relation to the expenditure. In fact, you mentioned that the tax is already high, that in funding moving forward, you can't increase that tax, otherwise you'll run into trouble. But I just want you to explain that in relation to the current situation that of the recession and downturn, how else do you manage the challenges that we have if you don't do that? So you might be able to explain that. The second question in relation to this slide here, the government this savings is unwelcome, that bullet. And I think that that question we need to just explain that in the context of the current environment, the medium-term policy statement has been presented, has incurred a bit of savings before, that as a way to cushion the work forward in terms of the recession. How else do you do a turnaround to that to come to that slide? Another question I think has already been asked, this issue about the current payment of 57%. By the look of it, it does look high, but well, how else do you manage that? What becomes the turnaround? Well, you suggesting, without saying so, some degree of social partners deal in managing that. So you're suggesting a tripartite deal that we now have to constrain this current payment for this period. So there's a hidden language which I don't understand, because you already have the level of current payment at a particular level. Moving forward, how do you then get it done? What would be the ingredients, or what would be the tools to be able to implement in order to get you to that particular position? Thanks.
Thank you, Mpate Ramatlaka.
Thank you, Chair. Just from my side, we find that there's provisions are made in the budget for salaries and wages, and quite as you quite rightly said, major amounts, but the bodies are not actually there. And we find that towards the end of the year, that people use that money that they divided in the budget to roll over, and they say, I'm not going to fill these positions, so I'm just rolling over the funds, and this we find more and more. And would it not be, in your opinion, be a good idea to actually freeze those positions at the moment and only look at each individual position, in the civil service before they are filled, to make sure that they're absolutely necessary before they're filled?
Thank you, Honourable Lien.
Thanks, Chairperson. The first question, Chair, is on page 6. And I also want to suggest that we need to, in the name of quality assurance, number our document. Because we take up this document and give it to our communities, and then they won't be able to engage it.
The first question, sir, is around the tax burden being too high to accommodate further increases. Now, to avoid cutting spending on service deliverables, is there maybe any contemplation to maybe introduce an automatic inflation management so as to ensure that the service deliverables are not affected by the escalation of costs? Then on the issue of on the same issue of the burden being too high to introduce, I mean to accommodate further increases, what if maybe because there is this global warming and climate changing that takes place now, and there might be a commitment that is made by the globe, so we are included there. What if maybe there is a suggestion that says introduce special taxes to the best polluters? Will that maybe affect the mechanism that you want to employ in relation to manage the manner in which taxes are to avoid further increases? Thank you.
Other options for taxation? Hosh, give yourself now.
Thanks, Chairperson. I also just wanted to run down this issue of taxation. I just wanted to check in the view of the presenter, what would be the most acceptable tax level? Because I understand that he's saying that we are already on the high. And the one side as well to maybe respond to, if our tax levels are high now, given the competing needs that we have to redress or to reconstruct, how can we do that without increasing taxation? And also just to check the how much we can really stretch corporate tax before attracting this investment. I think that is basically my question. But also, I think on response, I just need him to just to spend some few seconds explaining some of the things that he has raised, which I was not clear on them. There is a statement that says must reduce spending and taxes. To me, because I'm not an economist, I'm sure maybe I'll need a little bit of time to understand that. Which, how do you reduce spending and also reduce the taxes? And because I think I thought that these are two sides of a coin. The way I'm looking at it, and if you could just explain to me what that means. And also, the question that our rent is overvalued, from which side is he looking at that rent? Probably maybe I'll understand, because I'm sure there may be two sides of looking at the rent. If you say it's overvalued or undervalued, and then from which side, and is it the same sentiment from both sides? Also, there was a statement that says the social democratic developmental state is a difficult model. and what informs that? What informs this particular statement? And so that one is actually on par. The other issue is that there is another statement that says our expenditure GDP ratio needs to be reduced aggressively. I'm not sure which factor here needs to be dealt with. Whether is he referring to reducing the expenditure, and because that is the one factor that will actually get that ratio going down. But then are we saying that we need to pay more attention on exports? What does that mean? And then how then do we deal with our internal supply to our own consumption? I think I just needed to get some little bit of clarity on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mashile. Madam, did you have your hand up? Tetal Apen Pope, Madam.
So I just wanted to find out from Mr. Lapin. Thanks for your presentation, but I wanted to ask a similar question regarding the developmental space. Developmental space. Sorry, maybe the channel is going to give us a contribution towards the restricting our system and donate. That one is green, that one is red, which one is green? Can you hear me now? Now, if you can just give us the factors that you have actually already used to announce that the developmental space as a model is not going to be seen or deliver efficiency and effectiveness. And if so, what is then the better model? What would you advise us? Which of these models which you think is going to be effective and efficient? Because we are interested, we are here like an advisor, so we'd love to do the better thing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. My co-chairperson is there. Okay. Now, also just from my side, I'm interested by the balance between 1992-93 and today. And in that, I'm just you're showing, is it on slide 4, ne? About the personal taxes and the corporate taxes. At one stage, the personal is higher, now this time, the corporate is that is going to be higher. What will be the balance of that in today's, what you call it? I see it as a balance. In that, at that time, there were things that were higher, and today there are areas that are better than, in fact, on both, some areas are better than today, and today the areas that are worse off than we were in 1992. How will this period assist us to manage this, to manage this ship through these waters, stormy waters, with this balance? The other question, Clarice, is around the one slide says, no, our macroeconomic stability is foundational. Now, with that statement alone, does that statement give us hope that moving forward with our present current macroeconomic foundation, we have a chance of sustaining ourselves?
But also there are other questions that are arising in terms of your inflation, contribution of the low inflation to this in order to maintain this. They are not only international, I mean even within the country, there are those debates that say, do we keep this inflation targeting, does it assist us in issues like job creation, for instance? How do you strike this balance to ensure that we do, I mean this statement of the MTPPS is very strong around job creation, but we know that there are challenges in terms of why we are finding ourselves unemployment at the rate that's where we are. But now, how do you balance it? That's the last comment, is around the salary increase. Is going to be perhaps impact negatively as we move forward, as you're saying. But generally, what are the positive things that can we can derive from that in increases? I'm just thinking about people contributing back to tax. Is it necessary? Negative, isn't there a positive, what you call a side of it? I hope I'm making sense. Thank you very much. The reason why we're asking questions is because we assume that everyone is done, so that we want to close to move now.
So I
just want to say that in future we give opportunity to everyone. Once we have given that, we close it, we move forward. Please.
Well, thanks, Chair. Mine is one question. It's from the presenter's statement. He mentioned that the minister also acknowledged the complexity of this problem. And also, from your statement, you said we have a bumpy road ahead of us. The road is so bumpy ahead of us. Do we have a strong shock absorber to sustain that bumpy, if the case may be? Thanks, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Lofsa, thank you.
I have 22 questions, Mr. Dear. So I think I'll have to be very, very brief and to the point as far as each question is concerned. Now, if I can start there right at the beginning then, why revenue is now more cyclical? If we compare 92-93 to now, in 92-93, government revenue increased by almost 6%, roughly 6%, whereas now we have a decline of about 10% in nominal terms compared to, 6% compared to last year. And the reason why it was so positive in 92-93 is because the increase in personal income tax more than compensated for the decline in company taxes, the decline in VAT and things like that. And having now moved to a situation where we've given tax relief to individuals over the last number of years, substantial amounts, so we've reduced the amount of taxes taken from individuals, and that tax component being more stable. We've reduced the stable component, we've increased the more cyclical component being corporate taxes, and that's why it's now more cyclical than what it was previously. And I'm not saying it's anything bad. I'm saying it's something that is just bear in mind, and we have to plan for it and we have to live with it. On the welfare state, whether spending on social security should be reduced, no, I'm in agreement with you there. I'm not proposing that. What I am saying is that if that's a high priority for us, we must just balance that against our other priorities. And for example, I get the impression, and I might be mistaken, but from the way it's phrased, that the increase in the child grant from next year, that extra 7 billion, Then that's perhaps not yet reflected in the on the expenditure numbers that we see. Now, I wouldn't propose therefore that we shouldn't do it. I think if we do it, then we say, okay, but where can we save 7 billion in somewhere else then to get our priorities in line? The wages, the number of questions about public sector wage bill, 57%, what's a more manageable level? I would like to see that below 50%, I think. And the closer we can get to 40, the better. Now, that's not something that we can do overnight. It's a very, very long-term objective that you will have to have. But the fact of the matter is that we now have the situation that we have this last chunk of expenditure that we can't really manage its size in any way. The developmental state, a number of questions about that, so perhaps I can deal with them together. Now that the whole model of the developmental state, of course, originated in the East, Japan specifically, but I think South Korea and Taiwan, the other two countries that specifically been studied as examples of developmental states. Now, that the developmental state took on a very specific character in those cases. It was, one should also see it, I think, against a very specific historic background at that stage, which doesn't apply today, and numerous differences. I don't have the time to go into that. But I think perhaps I can just summarize it by saying that the term developmental state, I think, now gets used perhaps a bit more loosely in a different way than what the original meaning of it actually was. And what we perhaps should strive for is in defining the developmental state in the South African context as a state that is enhancing the economic activity, that's accepting the reality of competition. One of the important points of the developmental state in the East was that they accepted international competition as something that they have to deal with, and they have to make the country competitive. So what we should aim for, therefore, is a smart state and not necessarily a bigger state. And specifically, then, as far as the social democratic developmental state is concerned, the developmental state in its original form paid very, very little attention to social needs. It didn't burden itself with that. Now, once again, I'm not saying that we are wrong. If that's our choices that we make, then it's fine. But then we must just bear in mind that put certain constraints on us in as far as other things are concerned that we could do. Then there was a question about tax being too high, how one can manage that. My argument was that I don't think we should aim for further increase in the tax burden. If we want to reduce the tax burden, and there was a question about that also, some years ago government had a stated objective of a tax to GDP ratio of not more than 25%. So we are substantially above that aim at this point in time. But the fact is that if you look at the growth studies, you will find that the higher tax burdens, higher levels of government expenditure that goes with higher tax burdens, generally is not good for growth. Most of it because your growth comes from the private sector, and the more you increase the government's take on the available resources in the economy, you in the end up with lower growth. And that ties in with the other question also, to say therefore that when I say reduce taxes and reduce expenditure, I don't mean that we must now in the next year aggressively cut that. I think in terms of our growth strategy, our long-term growth strategy, we should keep in mind that smaller governments are generally better for your economic growth performance. Government debt saving, of course, means that you borrow money for current expenditure, and that can come right in various ways. For example, if over time we have further increases in capital expenditure, capital expenditure just grow more quickly than current expenditure, that by itself will also put you right. Now, the debt saving declines. Projected to decline over the next couple of years. So the trend is already in the right direction. But the fact is, as long as we have it, it complicates our current account situation. Manage it. I'm back to the government wage bill again. How to manage that. The fact is now, if you look at the projections going forward from here on for compensation of employees, it is budgeted to grow by, on average, 6.6% per year over the medium-term budget period. Now, at the same time, government is forecasting inflation over that period of roughly about 6%. So that's almost no real increase. Now, either that means that public servants will have to have less than inflation compensating increases over the next couple of years to allow for the additional appointments. We've specifically mentioned, for example, that we will get additional policemen, or it implies that those people can't be appointed. So that's the choice that we have to make. That's the only way to manage it. But for the time being, in terms of vacancies, freezing vacancies, one don't actually want to freeze vacancies in the recession when you have the kind of poor employment outcomes that we've seen recently. But I would say that you have to be circumspect about the balance between vacancies and service delivery. That you can freeze deliveries, but vacancies, but only to the extent that it doesn't impact negatively on delivery. You see about global warming and taxes. That's mentioned as a possibility, of course, in the medium-term budget statement that we can get new environmental taxes. Now, the purpose of those taxes should not be to raise revenue. The purpose of the taxes should be to influence behavior and to influence decision making so as to get more sustainable growth from energy usage perspective in particular. If you keep everything else the same, of course, then if you introduce new taxes, the tax burden is going to increase. I just want to point out that a higher and higher tax burden in the end is negative for the total level of economic activity. Let me see. Chair, I've now talked a lot and I've crossed over from one question to another that I'm not quite sure which questions I've not answered in the process. Perhaps I should rather to look at work backwards again from the questions and the last questions. The question about the bumpy road ahead, whether we had shock absorbers. We had shock absorbers, certainly. That's why we are in a position now to have a counter-cyclical fiscal policy. And we are not alone in it. The fact of the matter is that we can't afford another shock of this magnitude. We've used the shock absorbers. So therefore, we have to plan to repair the shock absorbers, to restore them so that in the event that in the future there should be a similar kind of shock, and if you look at history, shocks do happen, then that we have the leeway then. But as I said, we are not alone in that. I think right across the world there are many other countries that are actually in much worse position than us in terms of having used all of the shock absorbers. On the salary increase, that it has positives also in terms of taxes that goes back to government on increased spending in recessionary times. That is true, of course, but the I would say that the problem is that this is not anti-cyclical additional spending in the sense that you can withdraw it once the cycle has turned. This is now built into government expenditure forever. And that is rather for me the issue that it's been done that way. If you wanted to stimulate the economy by way of additional expenditure, you should have done it in a way that would have been more of a one-off nature. For example, you could have given social pensioners a bonus, for argument's sake, a one-off bonus, and you don't repeat it in future. So perhaps I should stop there because I've now talked a lot.
Yeah, I know you'd want to have a second bite, Hoshimashile, but let me just explain how you're going to handle this matter, this process. Madlamini also want to have a say on this issue. But let's not lose focus of the fact that the two presenters basically have got a common topic. Now, what we're thinking here from the table side is that we should allow IDASA to make its presentation. And those questions that are still outstanding from this presentation may actually be overlapping in the next presentation itself. So we'll still raise those questions after this presentation. So, Jacques, you are requested to stay behind and receive the presentation from your colleague. And I think we'll have more and a proper coordinated discussion once we've got all the inputs. Thank you. Over to you, Mr. Sorbet. Yeah.
Why are you still trying to find this speech? Are you saying that he will be available to respond to those questions?
Yeah. No. In fact, he's going to have a double bite, which is a little bit unfair, but I think it's okay. It's information. Nobody gets penalized for giving more information.
Thank you, and good morning. Yeah, I think you'll find there's a fair amount of. Sorry, let me introduce myself before I jump right in. My name's Len Pavey. I'm with IDASA here in Cape Town, and I'm just going to focus mostly on public finances. And I think you'll find there's a fair amount of overlap with the previous presentation. So where I feel that it's that there's quite an obvious overlap, I'm not going to belabor the point too much. I think it's a starting remark. I mean, my sense is that it is a very distinctive time, and it has created a unique set of circumstances from a public finance perspective as well. Sort of a crisis and a set of circumstances not of our own making, but obviously it is correct to evaluate government's response and to ask the kind of questions that came up in the previous presentation as well. I'm going to look sort of very briefly at four dimensions, four ways that I've been thinking about this. Looking at some key aspects of the 2009-10 budget, because I mean, in a way that, in other words, obviously the fiscal year that we're in currently, in a way that was and is the decisive
budget because of some of its divergences from what was proposed, etc., and I'll talk a little bit about that. Then I'll look at how the 2009 MTBPS takes that burden. Because in a sense, obviously, the MTBPS, which sketches out some of the parameters for the next 3 years, is and has to be informed by what we feel is happening this year. And so for me, it's quite obvious to link the two. The dimension of risk, which I think the previous presenter has well touched on and in numerous ways. You know, have we, in a sense, really established a different risk profile for public finances in South Africa? And then the final question, which I put quite bluntly, what now? And I'll conclude with some discussion points on that. I think that you'll find that my presentation goes less into the nitty-gritty of the numbers and than drug lapses, but I'm hoping they complement each other fairly well. All right. I think just some very basic aspects, which, as I say, have been touched on. The 09-10 budget, when we compare it to the previous year, there's a nominal increase of almost 17% for public spending. And that is on top of the previous increase, which was also in that order of magnitude. So in these 2 years, we had inflation of, let's say, 8-9%. So real increases of 10% for 2 years in a row, mainly related to the need and the desire to increase infrastructural spending as well, which obviously was a key dimension. And I mean, in 2006 and 2007, this looked very feasible. Clearly, we'd had. When there was controversy as well, it was in this committee, it tended to be about why we're having budget surpluses. But, members will recall this as well, that was the kind of debate we were having, why budget surpluses, can't we do more? So it was the correct time, given what we knew in 2006, 2007, and even some of 2008, to say now is the time we really embark on an infrastructural expansion. Now is the time we really present significant large increases in public spending, because at that point it was clearly defendable. The crisis hit, it wasn't our fault, and obviously public finances changed as a result of that. Just for interest's sake, the real GDP growth forecast of 2009-10 was 1.4% at that point, in February. I mean, at that point we already knew we were in a recession. So, it had already been revised downward significantly. But so in February, we were saying that this economy was going to grow by 1.4% in 2009-10. And members will know that we're now looking at a contraction of about 2% for the same period. A logical question there, of course, is should the Minister of Finance at that point, the central Trevor Manuel, and should the National Treasury have based their forecasted more conservatively. But I mean, if you look back, and we did in our February response, you'll see most of the other institutions who present some sort of forecast roughly agreeing at that point, specifically the Bureau for Economic Research and Senate Bank as well, were saying roughly this. So it was a realistic estimate of what was going to happen in 2009-10 at that point. According to a kind of consensus, and on the basis of that, of course, we had a budgeted deficit of 3.8%, and we now sitting with 7.6. This is a very simple slide, but it just shows this is non-interest expenditure. This is what 09-10 proposed. So that gap there, right to the right, is a deficit of 3.8% of GDP. And you'll see, of course, that already built into that there was the sense of the need for a deficit-style response to the recession as well. The problem, of course, is how far away from that we moved, mainly due to underestimating growth and also, therefore, underestimating tax revenue. So these are the divergences, that's what I'm calling them, the divergences that define the 09-10 budget as we understand it at the moment. Significant divergence of growth. We budgeted for we assumed 1.4% positive growth. We might end up with negative 1.6 over the fiscal year now. Tax revenue, I think these have been so well covered in previous discussions. Divergence of expenditure, and then a very large deficit as well. So the 2009 MTBPS, which obviously sets 10, 11, 11, 12, and 12, 13,
have to proceed from that, and in evaluating what we say about it, we have to assess how realistic it is as well. Some of the assumptions are fairly modest growth, as you know. 2%, 3%, 3% over the 3 NTBPS years. There's also an assumption that public sector investment will contribute quite significantly to that growth, state-owned enterprises. So the public sector borrowing requirement, as again the previous presenter also made the point, that's a large component of borrowing which we can add to government borrowing as well. And then the assumption, of course, that we see in the NTBP is that tax revenue will recover more slowly than growth. So even though we're saying, for example, the economy is going to grow in real terms by 2%, we're not expecting tax revenue to grow at an equal pace. The household debt overhang was mentioned in the previous presentation. That would perhaps primarily affect VAT and corporate income tax as well. The personal income tax is performing reasonably well in 2009-10. The problems are really on the corporate income tax and the VAT. As a result of this, on the revenue side, what we're seeing is a fairly large deficit. This is the deficit including interest that I'm putting here. All of this is kind of obvious, but given all of this, we're still only looking at a real rate of increase in government spending of about 1% on average for the next 3 years. So it's quite a tricky position, because what else perhaps could we do right now? It's very difficult for any government to cut spending, as you know. These deficits that are being presented here are what is that required in order to really keep government spending constant in real terms over the next 3 years. So that really reflects two things in my view. The one is the extreme slowness of specifically tax revenue recovery, and also how, in a way, ambitious our 08-09 and 09-10 response and budget was, and then 09-10 specifically the response to the crisis. It's kind of like it put us up on a plateau there. And now it's very tricky, for political as well as social reasons, government can't cut spending in real terms. I don't think that in history very rarely has that been an option. But the kind of plateau that the 09-10 budget put us on, following on the preceding one, we are obviously really struggling and going to struggle to keep that constant in real terms. So that's another way for me of looking at the challenge. I'm sure you've heard, and it's also in the NTBPS, that South Africa had quite a significant difference between our sort of pre-budget deficit or budget balance and plus. It was a very strong response, and it was a viable response aside from the fact that I think there was a significant underestimation of tax revenue. Does it raise questions about the credibility of the NTBPS as such? I think that's an interesting question. We might touch on it in our discussions. I have flagged it, if we were to look back at forecasts over the years as well, should that be somewhere where we should also ask in questions? This is just tax revenue as a share of GDP. And the reason I put this slide in here is it just illustrates as well I'm sorry if they're a little bit unclear, that even though you'll see the deterioration of tax as a share of GDP, which points to the fundamental problem, which is as our economy entered a recession, tax revenues declined by a proportionately even larger amount and are recovering by a proportionately slower amount. Because if they were constant, if your economy contracts by 2%, your tax revenue would decline by 2%. That's not what we have at this point. So as a result of this strong, if you like, over-response from tax revenue and very sluggish recovery, that even if we grow at 2% and 3% and 3%, we still sit with very large deficits. Perhaps, you'll have to excuse me, but I'm sometimes fond of making quite obvious points. And for me, an interesting obvious point is that we're looking at 2%, 3%, 3% real GDP growth, according to the NTBPS, but still very, very sizable deficits, 6%, 5%, 4%.
that point to a number of things, but one of them point, one of them is how slowly we are saying tax revenue is going to recover. In a way, it perhaps points to some aspect of household behavior in South African household behavior, which was not dissimilar to what perhaps may have contributed to the crisis in the northern developed nations. Households clearly got over indebted, and they did so in a boom period. So, I mean, I think they were probably doing what many people do. They would, a lot of households were doing very well, and just assumed they would do even better in the future. And I think that drove household indebtedness, which is certainly slowing our recovery going forward now. I think Jacques Lobster has covered a lot of these points on the debt, aspects of the debt quite well, so I don't want to elaborate on this too much. Just putting on some sort of key salient aspects of it. That debt costs are in the NTBBS as well estimated about 3.2% of GDP. It's about 100 billion, I think more interestingly perhaps it's almost 10% of consolidated expenditure. And debt servicing costs over this medium term rise at a much faster rate than what is proposed for total consolidated expenditure. Right. And this is just from the 2009 budget, in fact. It's from a statistical table at the back, which I've just drawn up. Again, I apologize for the not very clear. This goes back to, I think it's 1984-85. And you can see debt as a share of GDP peaking in the early 90s, significant decline. The blue line is, if you look right to the right, the blue line that kind of where it starts going up again and is sort of, there's a hint of it plateauing there at the end of the blue line. That was the 09-10 budget's response to the crisis, if you like, where it recognized that there was a requirement for deficit spending to stimulate the economy. So you see the blue line representing that. The pink line is where we are at now as a result of tax revenue doing much worse than we expected. So you see, instead of a fairly moderate intervention that would increase debt as a share of GDP a little bit and kind of have it plateau out over the medium term, this was what was proposed in February, instead we're to get an appreciable increase in NTBBS 09 already. That obviously reflects the difference in revenue that we thought and what we, you know, what we thought we'd get and what we're getting. And as you can see, it's a very sharply rising line. The only sharper increase really there in the early 90s. I think a previous presenter also mentioned the 50% of GDP as a kind of a sensitive line. You'll see we came very close in the early 90s. So, and that would be very, it would be very difficult to just kind of plateau that pink line again. You know, it wouldn't be that simple. I think there are various reasons to think we might, you know, we might continue with some deficits as well, and then we will hit 50% of GDP debt by 2012-13. Yeah, I mean, I think the debt scenario and the risk of, you know, when we assess that as well, we have to ask after the realism of growth forecast, the realism of revenue forecast as well. I think they, it's a difficult question. I think that if you look at just 2010-11, without looking into the technical side of it, I think the kind of assumptions of real GDP growth that are in the NTBBS are consistent with what most commentators are saying for what that's worth. So we can't say that there's a sort of an institutional bias towards optimism. I think there's a fair caution in the real GDP growth forecast for 2010-11, which I think is good. And I think the revenue forecasts are possibly cautious as well, although I mean, I think inherently it is quite a scary thing, if I can put it like that. If a finance minister in presenting his budget points out the need for either significant broadening of tax of the tax base, significant improvements in tax compliance, or introduction of new taxes. I mean, those are the three things that the Minister of Finance mentioned. Basically, that finance minister then saying is that the way this scenario is at the moment, it's probably not sustainable, and we are going to have to look at other means of making it sustainable. Right, so that is that points to an awareness that there is a very large risk in this framework specifically. Right. Entrenchment of a higher deficit culture, that's a vague kind of way of phrasing it, but we've had, you know, we have had globally, we know that people get kind of used to deficits. It becomes part of their thinking, unfortunately, perhaps. So it's not just, so that's another risk that we feel that the South African economy and public finances can, in fact, sustain more debt than the reality might appear to be. All right, so I think this slide, the what now, just makes the point that I made earlier as well, that the 09-10 budget, when I say the problem, I don't mean that in the sense of pointing fingers, but I mean that in the sense of saying that's the budget, the 09-10, in other words, the fiscal year we're in as well. This is where things went off on a different path. Mm-hmm. And the NPBPF cannot now simply say, okay, 09-10 was a bad year, but let's just cut spending and balance the books and carry on as normal. I mean, obviously you cannot do that. Yeah. By way of conclusion, just five discussion points that I think would be interesting for this committee as well. There's really basically two ways that the MTBPS seeks to rescue the situation, if I can put it that way. The one is what I've mentioned by looking at the tax side of the budget and saying we need new taxes, we need to broaden the base, we need to improve compliance. The other one, this whole issue of waste, inefficiency, and value for money. I think it's a very welcome emphasis on the part of the minister. I think it was an emphasis he also in the provincial budget and expenditure review a couple of months ago. He made similar emphasis on the importance of value for money. And our parliament, as members will know better than me, is tasked with oversight, including really ensuring that we get value for money from spending. And our members will also know that that's a very difficult thing, conceptually as well as in terms of information requirements. It's one thing to say we need to eliminate waste, or we need to, for example, eliminate soft consulting that a department might not need. It's a completely different thing to sit with a given accounting officer and decide for his or her department, you know, this is valid, this is not valid, this is value for money, this isn't. I mean, things aren't that simple. You don't always know what is essential or not in a given department spending. So I think it's important on the level of emphasizing that we need to, this is a more austere period. But when we say, when there are these estimates that we can save X number amount of money by getting rid of non-core personnel and that kind of thing, I'm quite concerned, I'm quite skeptical about that, about how you achieve it with a given department. Right. What kind of oversight, for example, is required to achieve that? I touched on the taxes. Job creation, also something that needs, I mean, the MTBPS speech as well emphasized that. Again, it's easier said than done, isn't it? I mean, how precisely does government go about creating jobs? This is a debate South Africans have had for a long time. We know it's a key challenge. It's not particularly easy. The credibility of the NPBPS forecast is just something I'm bringing up here because it has been such a significant divergence. Growth and tax revenue in 09-10, both have diverged markedly from what was proposed in February. I'm not sure that anybody else did a better job, so let me state that clearly, in terms of growth forecasts as well. In fact, I made the point very clearly that if you look at some of the private sector estimates, National Treasury's was quite conservative when we compare it to that. But there is a need for perhaps asking these questions and looking back at the record of the MTBPS forecast in general as well. All right, I'm going to like end it there, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you. Colleagues, I'm told that tea is ready. I'm going to propose that we break for tea for 10 minutes and come back and engage with the two submissions once again. Thank you. Unless you don't want tea, you can continue. You want to continue? All right. Okay. Guarano, you'll be followed by Munna Musutu, Len Matagan, and then Dr. George. Khoisimashik. All right. And then after Khoisimashik, it will be Madamir. All right.
Thank you.
Fire.
Thank you, Chairperson. If you look at this policy statement by the Honourable Minister, he says that South Africa's recovery is closely linked to the fortunes of the world economy. And what I would like to ask both economists, whether they think South Africa are so closely linked to the recovery of the world economy, and that if we will recover at the same speed as the rest of the world. And secondly, if you look at the latter part of next year, all construction will come to an end in terms of 2010, the World Cup. Is that going to have a negative impact on the economy, the construction industry coming to a standstill?
Thank you, Chair. There's a question about the projection.
Am I hearing that? Honorable Van Rooyen and Madamin, we don't want you to repeat other people's questions later on. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair. And I just want, there was this discussion of projection that you make in terms of the increase in borrowing in terms of percentage, and you're projecting it probably in the region of 50% by 2012, if I got you correctly. Now, the question I want to ask really is in terms of the borrowing, what would you characterize as a good measure of borrowing? Would you compare to the GDP, the growth that you project, and understanding the current challenges? And borrowing, and you know, in terms of the document that was presented by the minister, he speaks about infrastructure, borrowing for infrastructure, driving infrastructure development, which is a good thing. But what is your comment in relation to split of the borrowing itself in terms of what would go to what is a social infrastructure and what is basically infrastructure development that generates the income in terms of offsetting the growth in terms of debt? What would you see as a good split around that kind of borrowing and investment? Those are the two questions for me. I'm sure it does not necessarily go to one. It probably goes to both presenters.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Mr. Fabay, for your presentation. I want to make reference to the document you gave us, this one. On page number 12, you make mention in the second paragraph about the 2009 Money Rules Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, providing for Parliament with strong powers to amend the budget and should therefore also have a positive impact on participation. You then go on to say from a broad fiscal government perspective, the aim is not to have a proliferation of amendments simply because an act now exists which allows them. And this is the thing I'd like you to comment on. regarding your specific concerns, you go on to say, nor should the risks of amendment from an undercapacitated parliament be underestimated. What specifically are you concerned about? And then, if I understood you correctly, you said that it's very difficult for government in practice to actually cut its size or expenditure. Now, I don't necessarily agree with you, because, for example, if you look at Canada and Sweden, they started with fairly large-ish government, and they've been able to pare it back now to get some savings. So the issue is about political will. In South Africa, there actually is a lot of space to cut. Our bureaucracy is bloated, it is inefficient, and the state-owned entities lead taxpayer money that actually should be going to the poor for service delivery. So do you think that it's impossible for government to do that? Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Yes, thanks, Chairperson. I just wanted to repeat, I think, two of the previous questions which I raised, which I thought that I sought for an explanation, but I could not get, you know, within the response that I have received. One question was in relation to how far can we stretch investors through corporate tax before we start attracting disinvestment. Surely there should be a break point somewhere. And, you know, reading intercontinental, intercountry, what do you think it is more or less the level of taxation that you can impose before you start getting negative responses from the investor? If we can be indulged on that one. And also, I think I just tried to check, you know, on the statement, because we hear every time about people coming up in the media saying that our rent is overvalued, and then I think I just requested to understand, when you also say it is, the rent is overvalued, from which side are you looking at this rent? From export or from import, or what's the story? Or is it a common position about our rent from both directions? And then, Chair, one of the comments I think of Jack, I think, was that when he was responding to the last question, was in to say that taxes are meant to influence behavior and not to raise revenue. If I have been correct. Now, my understanding was that tax is the main component of raising revenue by government. Now I'm finding a serious contradiction, unless if I'm you know, it's, I'm given some serious lecture on this particular matter, Chair. And the last question, Chair, is that we have had a lot of service delivery matches, which when we try and interpret it, is that a lot still needs to be done to meet the demands of people, or to meet the social demands out there. And many of those issues, of course, need high levels of spending. And now we are in the recession. And one can understand that even though we are in the recession, people would not suspend their demand for service delivery. Now, for some reason, is that we need to get a balance in between. Then you have got the comments from the economists, I think, may be coming from traditional economic perspectives. But one has heard the Minister of Finance saying that he will go back and clip fat and put it and transform it to flesh and put to bones where there is fat. which means there is something different that the minister is thinking in responding to the shortage of financial resources. It's not just simply going to be traditional way of raising funds. Now I just wanted to understand whether the economic responses are actually informed as well by what the minister intends to do to actually solve those funds to meet our social demands, or are they purely academic in the traditional way of economy? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. My humble request is directed to Mr. Lapshaw. Am I pronouncing the same correctly? You know, you have made a very strong point when you said the developmental state as a model is complex. It's true, we all understand that. And in fact, all models are complex, but at the end of the day, it's the policy that is working well for the majority party that is leading the country. Now, why then it becomes my request to you is that Sanlam is amongst the biggest companies within our country, which we can utilize if we want to borrow. Now, is it possible that we establish an effective partnership with Sanlam so as to avoid the society aspiration? Much as it is complex, but what advice would you say? We are the parliament, and as the parliament, it could be an opposition or the majority party, but at the end of the day, we are accountable to the society. So the society, the societal aspirations are to be addressed. And we are saying the best model is a developmental state model. Now, I was expecting the Sanlam to say, look, parliamentarians, this is what you're proposing, these are the advantages, these are the disadvantages, this is the way forward, because we cannot go alone, we need you. As a model, we need that partnership, you need to be on board. So I'm still humbly saying, if we are not ready, is it possible that maybe in future we get, you say, much as this is the model, this is how we see it, and seemingly the Sanlam has got a different understanding as far as this model of developmental space. I do understand Sanlam, they look at the bottom number, which must be plus all the time, while on the other side we're looking at the aspirations and the societal needs. So I do understand. Thank you, Chair.
Maybe before you respond, just one contribution from my side, and this is more to Jack. You see, just around the issue of the developmental state also, I find you actually have made a comment that says the concept of a developmental state is just used very loosely now of late. But in your presentation also, I find you conflating social democratic state with a developmental democratic state, because to me those two are distinct institutions or governments. Secondly, tied to that, we have raised the issue of high taxation almost at the level of 30% now. And also advocating reduction in expenditure. I want to suggest, I want to assume that that expenditure you are referring to state expenditure, not only in terms of welfare and in terms of wages. And how do you see that in terms of the role of the state in terms of a developmental agenda if it's going to reduce its expenditure, basically leading development?
So that's one part that I thought, and my experience so far, I know we're not in the same category as the high income group, who countries that could regard themselves as social democrats, like Sweden or the Scandinavians, their tax bracket is very, very high compared to what we have here. And I think it is precisely informed by the welfare program or social security network that they provide for their population. And then they're talking about in a country where you've got frictional unemployment, basically. But now, afraid, I think the unemployment level is going a little bit high. But over the years, it was frictional unemployment, ranging between 3% and 5%. Over to you. You can choose who starts. I mean, and there's no question specifically to anybody. Your economy, I assume.
Patricia, shall I just go through everything that I feel I can add value to and then hand over to the other presenter, if that's acceptable? Alright, I'll respond to the questions that were specifically posed to me and then just add some comments where I feel I can add value. On the links to the world economy and how that was the first question, the recovery in the world economy. Clearly, we are closely linked to the world economy in the sense that the crisis affected us quite strongly. So clearly, we are linked. Will that in the negative sense? Yes. In the positive sense, will we recover as quickly as other countries? I think the household debt overhang is probably one of the main constraints that would slow down our recovery in relation to some of the other economies. I think there's two positives bringing it to next year as well, and the end of some of the World Cup spending. The one is some of the easing of monetary policy. I'm not sure it's really worked its way through the economy yet, which would be a positive for 2010-11. And the other one would be obviously the kind of tourism impulse of 2010. So aside from the infrastructural benefits of the World Cup, there will be not only tourism in the sense of people coming to spend money here, but staying, etc. Things that are quite difficult to quantify that might be quite positive as well. But in a nutshell, I think our recovery will be slower than some of the other economies. And I think the NCDP has also incorporated that thinking. On the appropriate level of debt, just to clarify my comment there, 41.1% is at the end of 2013, according to the NCDPS. And I said there were reasons to think it could go beyond 50%, but we don't know, of course. Those are assumptions. I'm going to quote a novelist, an American novelist, actually, Ernest Hemingway, who, in one of his novels, one of his characters describes how he went bankrupt. And he said, gradually and then suddenly. And I think I'm glad that I got some love, because it's quite a good line, yeah? And that's not, please, don't, I'm not presenting an alarmist scenario here about South Africa at all. My point is just, it's very difficult to assess, because the impact of a debt overhang gradually on public finances as it starts eclipsing other spending, that's subtle. And another subtle aspect is how investors regard your debt. And in that sense, we know that the world isn't necessarily fair to developing countries who are perceived as having the range of social challenges that South Africa has. So we probably can't sustain a debt percentage that some of the well-known cases of profligacy in the world can. But it's very hard to quantify. So I wouldn't want to say 40% is fine, 50% is fine. What's fine is what you can get away with and what doesn't start eclipsing spending and put your balance of payments under pressure. Social infrastructure, economic infrastructure, for me it's a difficult one to answer. A lot of the social infrastructure runs through the main budget, a lot of the economic runs through the state-owned enterprises. So I wouldn't want to, in percentage terms, break it down, because I think it's a little bit like comparing apples and oranges. On the capacity of Parliament, this quotation from this Parliament, the Budget and Poverty in South Africa book, where we said that the risk of amendment from an undercapacitated parliament should not be underestimated. I would distinguish at least three members might know, we brought out a book that covers some of this, and so this was alluding to some of the things there. The fundamental point is that, we have a shortage of analytical capacity in South Africa anyway. And this isn't about the capacity of members, but it's specifically about the capacity of research support for committees. And the point being that we've given Parliament strong powers to amend the budget, which is constitutionally required and I believe is democratically correct. So don't misunderstand me on that. But clearly, the kind of research support that Parliament gets will be decisive in terms of the quality of its engagement. And there are risks to that engagement, and so this comment just says that if Parliament is going to amend the budget, it needs to do so in a way where it really is quite certain it's going to add value. Some of those risks, I mean, there is some tendency, if you take a comparative and historical perspective, there is some association of legislatures with looser fiscal policy. The sort of the inability to impose a hard budget constraint. I think it's exaggerated, you know. Sometimes it ends up in an anti-democratic stance, you know. And I don't believe that. I think fundamentally macroeconomic policy should also be a democratic issue. But an under-capacitated legislature might struggle to impose that kind of... It might not get the appropriate advice from its analysts. That's the real point. Amendment overload is another one. I mean, just administratively, it would be difficult. And then thirdly, and this is perhaps less about undercapacitation, is obviously the risk of hijack. One of the chapters in this book looks at who actually comes to this committee as well as other committees in the past and makes submissions, you know. And therefore, whose views, you know, are heard more often. Now, we can't really, I mean, Parliament does do a fair amount of outreach work, so we can't do more than that. But the point there again is that would be another risk affecting the quality of Parliament's engagement. I hope that answered that question. On the disinvestment / tax rate issue, I personally would respond to that in a similar way to which I responded on the debt issue. I think it would be nice, but I don't think you can say a particular tax rate then you start getting disinvestment. And for the simple reason that I don't think companies, when they're considering investing in South Africa, look only at that. And I think there are studies that confirm my view. They certainly look at growth prospects, but they look at also the environment. Things like crime, things like labor legislation, all of these things play a part in whether, you know, specifically foreign direct investment, where companies decide to locate. So I wouldn't say that a particular tax rate, that it's as simple as that. You could have a high tax rate, and if you had efficient and effective spending that removes constraints to growth in your economy, then you would have companies quite eager to invest. You could have a low tax rate, waste a lot of that money, and they wouldn't be. Just to find out, and my final, I'm going to leave issues of the RAND and that kind of thing to Jacques Lapcher. On service delivery, you know, it's a very difficult discussion that we're still busy in probably in South Africa, where there are a lot of the problems we find with government performance, whether they are in fact problems of money or problems of management. You know, so I think the assumption that if you look at service delivery, part of the assumption that more money would solve the problem is, you know, it's also something that I think could do with some further robust discussion. There is evidence in some cases of shortage of finances, but there's also evidence of problems of management, i.e. using the money that is available. And clearly in the current environment where we're pressed for money, the way forward has to be about getting better management, which is partially about getting better oversight as well. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, let me first respond to one or two specific issues and then I'll come around to the issue of the developmental state again. I just want to add to the answer on how far can you stretch the corporate tax rate. At the moment, after having been reduced in the past 10 odd years, our nominal corporate tax rate is broadly in line with global standards. That doesn't need any further deduction. If it was to increase by 1 percentage point, probably that, in any case, won't make that much of a difference. I agree that corporates take other issues also into account. But then you have to look, of course, at effective tax paid by corporates, because you have the headline tax rate, and then there's all sort of deductions. Now, if you look at corporate tax as a percentage of GDP, then South Africa is on the higher side. Unfortunately, I don't have numbers with me. If you want me to, if you give me your email address, I'll try and get out the numbers for you and then mail it to you. But in that sense, in other words, it indicates that our effective rate is on the higher side compared to other countries. The question of the rand, I don't look at it from either export side or import side. There are numerous economic models for judging the value of a currency. The most basic one, the standard one, is its purchasing power parity. In other words, you would expect in the long run for a currency to either appreciate or depreciate by the inflation differential with its trading partners. Now, in our case, our inflation is higher than that in our trading partners, so you would expect the rand to, in the long run, to depreciate in line with that differential. And then you do get periods of time then where there's a deviation, and that's what we've had recently, that if you just look at the inflation differential, you would have expected the rand to have been somewhat weaker than it was. And that's where I come from when I say that the rand is overvalued. Then your question about my comment that taxes aimed at affecting behavior, not to raise revenue. I just want to point out I made that comment specifically in the context of environmental taxes. I did not make the comment in the context of taxes in general, all taxes. I think it's accepted that government has certain functions, and in order to deliver on those functions, they need revenue. And that's regardless of then specifically trying to affect behavior. But even in that case, one must bear in mind the way that you structure taxes, the way that you raise the necessary revenue, you create incentives in the process, and sometimes unintentionally, and that can also affect behavior. But just to reiterate, in the case of environmental taxes, the taxes are aimed specifically at, for example, reducing the carbon footprint. That is the aim of the tax. And the revenue that's raised, it wasn't in the first place introduced to raise revenue, it's introduced to affect behavior. Then on the developmental side, Chair, I feel like kicking myself here now. By putting that little sentence there in my presentation, because I think it's now creating a bit of a red herring and diverting from the issue of the medium-term budget policy statement. In the first place, let me just say that the social democratic developmental state that I refer to, that's not my term. It's government's term. And it's come from the presidency. And specifically, okay, he's now resigned, but Mr. Joel Letsatenzi, on more than one occasion, referred to South Africa as a social democratic developmental state. He recently, again, shortly before his resignation, used that terminology. So, and I think all that he said is that the standard idea about a developmental state, it's like the Asian model. As I said, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, that would be the best examples in the history of developmental state. And what he's saying is that we're not going that route. We add the social democratic part to it, in the sense that we have social high level, we try and best we can with a high level of social protection that we add to that. I would actually say, if you want to compare ourselves with other countries, perhaps the best example then would be France. I think France is sort of a social democratic developmental state. And that's more, in other words, the kind of category in which we are putting ourselves. I get the impression that you rightly said that I said the term is being used loosely. Because the term developmental state was defined by a man by the name of Chalmers Johnson in research that he did on the Japanese economy, and he used that term to specifically describe the role that the Japanese government played in Japan's economic development. It's now being used, I think, to mean other things also. And perhaps
What's also necessary is that each one of us, in using that term, should be sure, but what exactly do we mean by that? Because I get the impression, for example, what you might mean by developmental state is, for example, government by way of social expenditure, protecting and uplifting the poor. Now, that is not part of the original developmental state concept. So in the end, I think we must avoid semantics. In the end, it's about what do we want to achieve and how do we achieve it. And therefore, if I can refer back to an earlier question also about if that's not the model, then what model should we use? I think it's quite clear if one looks at research that's been done specifically on how do you enhance the growth performance of the economy. In the end, there's no fixed model that you can take from somewhere else and just can apply to your economy. You have to look at your own individual strengths and weaknesses, your own conditions, and you have to devise your own plans. And that is perhaps the model in the end that I would say that we need is a South African model. And if that model contains elements of the developmental state as applied in Asia, then that's fine. If it contains elements of European social democracy, if we've made that choice, then that is also fine. And then we have to, of course, then manage it, and we have to live with those outcomes. In terms of reducing taxation, reducing expenditure, I just want to say that, again, I did not mean that we must now, in the short run, in an absolute sense, reduce expenditure. I think that would be rather unwise, given the economic background. What I'm saying is that over time, we should reduce the overall size of government in the economy. We've now had a jump from 31% last year to 35% in government expenditure to GDP in that ratio. And that's unintentional. We didn't plan to do it. It wasn't a policy decision that we're now going to raise a government expenditure from 31 to 35% of GDP. So I think it's correct then for me, from the way I look at it, to assume that the purpose in the end is to bring it back to where it previously was. That's what counter-cyclical policy means, that you deviate for a temporary period and then you get back to your norm. And I think that's in that context that one should see it. Chair, it just crossed my mind, there's one important question from the lady there that I did not respond to now that I must get back to. You are very right that the developmental state in the Asian context also, one of the main characteristics of that kind of growth model is close cooperation between the private sector and the public sector. To an extent, actually, that you would say that perhaps takes it a bit too far, to the extent, for example, that if you take Japan, it's quite normal for civil servants to move into business, and likewise for people in the business sector temporarily for a couple of years to move into the civil service. Let's say, for example, in the DTI, in our case, that kind of relationship. Now, I wrote an article on this issue a few years ago, and that's one of the questions that I actually put, is whether in South Africa we have the whether that is that really possible in the South African context, that we can get that close kind of cooperation, but then also one must immediately say, if you take the Japanese model, there was virtually no corruption, because immediately when you start to bring corporate sector and government closer to one another, the opportunities, the possibilities for corruption just blossoms. There was virtually no corruption because there was a very competent, very professional, very dedicated people on both sides that made that model work. And certainly you referred now to Sanlam, and okay, I can't commit myself on Sanlam's behalf this morning, but I can tell you our approach all along in terms of how we conduct our business and our relationship with the different levels of government with which we interact is always to to be cooperative. Thank you.
Any more of them?
Sorry, Mr. Chairperson, there was one question that I didn't respond to that I would just like to very briefly. It was a question about cutting spending and the example of I stated that it's, you know, politically and socially very problematic, and the examples used with Canada and Sweden. I think in giving those examples, my job is actually completed in trying to answer that question, because I mean those are societies that are characterized by very high levels of equality and have addressed a lot of their social challenges. If one compares development indicators to South Africa, one would see that. So my answer would be that it's very difficult for countries such as South Africa, given the social challenges we face, to cut spending. Social challenges that we know also impact on the economy. I mean, you go into a fairly vague terrain, but the impact of inequality on levels of trust among South Africans and how that impacts on very hard indicators such as economic growth. Well, it's very difficult to model that. Those are significant as well. So this isn't just about some other realm, the social realm that matters, but that isn't related to the real economy. These realms very much influence each other. So social, political, and economic realms, as members will know, interact very closely. So from that perspective, it would be not only socially but economically very problematic to reduce spending in real terms at this point. Sorry, Chairperson, and just on the developmental state debate, I don't want to enter that, but in Evans, who's also one of the key writers on it, used the phrase embedded autonomy to characterize the developmental state, which is a state that it's embedded in society sufficiently to in a way provide a map to be informed by the preferences of society, but it's also autonomous, so it avoids the problems of rent seeking, of corruption, of strong lobbying that's not necessarily in society's best interest.
What's your material? You're aware of what? I just wanted to actually have a further explanation to the last comment, not necessarily the last, but the last but one from Mr. Lobsha, of saying the increase in expenditure to, I think he quoted 35%, is that we should be moving back, that it's a temporary thing, and he said it was an unintended consequence, if I understood correctly. But now I was, I actually just wanted him to reflect on this statement from the 2006 local government election, I think, of accelerating service delivery, one, and then the follow-up statement by the then president of Business Unusual, whether those two did not actually mean increased expenditure, because at those particular times we had rollovers and all that, and whether those statements did not imply heightened expenditure. I just wanted to have that view.
Just trying to find the numbers. Yeah. If you look at the budget earlier this year, then what was budgeted for this year was that government expenditure should be, total payment should be 33.7% of GDP. So that was already an increase from 31.3% estimate for last year, for this year, but then it was budgeted that it would go down to 32% by 2011-12. So that was in other words what fiscal policy said at that stage is implied. So what I'm saying is therefore the increase to 35%, that wasn't planned. Was it in the budget? It's the outcome of the change in the economic circumstances. And in that sense therefore I have no reason to think that the government is, there's no statement that says we change policy. That in over time it will be brought back to the kind of level that it was previously. That's just my interpretation of the numbers that I see before me. The other question was about
Braden is Honorable Dan Munsin. You don't call him Braden.
They call me Comrade Dan. Chairperson, let me just make a brief follow up on the. I know it might not be an issue. Let me state first my comment with respect to government investing in infrastructural development and in the economy in general. That if government participate actively in the economy, it means in essence the resources that government is plowing in the economy have the added impact also of contributing in growth, because you will have a situation in which delivery takes place, but at the same time there are more and more players in the economy who are involved, most in particular in construction if it is housing. And therefore, that also has a semblance of contributing in job creation. And government is also able to recoup taxes, you know, in terms of those other ventures which have come into the economy through the contribution of government. But the issue that I want to raise is with respect to the same statement that Honorable Mashika has been pursuing. Now, I will agree that government might not have necessarily planned, because the projected spending could have been 31%. That is fine. But now, if it has gone up to 35% in the current financial year, and therefore it must be taken back, or it must be balanced in order to or moderate it. I'm saying there are factors that might have contributed in the spending going up. Because when I look at your medium term budget policy statement which was presented to Parliament by Finance, there's a section that indicates the various growth in costs that have taken place, manufacturing and mining, for instance, which has increased, they say, in the 3 months to August, and then house prices, which have increased by 3.1% since June, and then also when you look at commodity prices, there are those various increments that you spoke about. It's gold, it's oil, it's platinum, etc. So obviously, despite the fact that government might have planned for a particular, has budgeted certain resources to be spent, it is outside government if there is escalation in the cost of delivering the process. So I think in a way I'm trying to explain why from 31% to 35%. Thank you, Jacques.
Okay, Jacques, Len.
I don't know what I should add now. As I said, that 35% wasn't planned. I think that's basically the question, just confirm that. But that it was largely outside government's control. I think the fact that the over expenditure is so small is a positive. What is a pity, as I pointed out earlier, is that 90% of the over expenditure is the result of an unplanned excess increase in wages and salaries. So that could have been avoided if government stuck to the budget.
Can I just add, I would just like to agree with Raghav Shoj. It would be a pity if this is a debate that goes forward, because this is really just a ratio. It's one way of, the government expenditure is a share of GDP. It's just one way of measuring, obviously, the share of government in the economy. And what happened here is simply that the denominator, I mean, you take spending and you divide it by a denominator, which is GDP. Now, if that denominator is smaller, then you get a bigger value. So, basically, spending has more or less stayed in line with what was intended. Inflation isn't an issue because it would affect both the numerator and the denominator equally, more or less. You see, so it's not an inflation issue, it's not an overspending issue, it's simply that your denominator, which is your GDP, is much smaller. So you're dividing by something smaller, so you get a bigger percentage. That's really all that's at stake here. And I think Jacques made this point as well earlier, that as your economy recovers, your GDP will be bigger. So automatically, that ratio will come down. Again, it's not a policy issue as such. It's just a question of how you're measuring it and what's happened in this year where GDP has contracted. The denominator has gotten smaller. There are obviously interesting discussions about the appropriate size of government in the economy, but this isn't the way into that discussion, because it really just reflects the really anomalous contraction we've had, and there will be an automatic impact on that as a result of GDP picking up to more normal levels next year and onward.
I don't know if there's still any more hands. On my left, I think they are all satisfied. On the right, I don't see any hands. Perhaps just a comment before Honorable DP summarizes our discussion and then gives us permission to go and do other things. Lapsha. I nearly said Lapskahni. That's all. I wanted to be sure that I'm going to say the right thing. And it goes to you, Len, that your input is an important contribution in the work of Parliament. And therefore, the interrogation is for us to understand things much deeper. Sometimes it will border on ideological contestation. And I think it's a wrong terrain to discuss. It is not. Honorable Munzisi has made a contribution in terms of the role of the state, particularly in what is called emerging economies, developing countries. From time to time, with different terminologies that you're either emerging or you're a developing country. That the issue of infrastructure expenditure, we must look at it from both economic and social infrastructure spending. The economic infrastructure is about catalyzing economic growth, which should then respond to the issue that we're talking about in terms of the size of debt to the GDP. Because we may actually be looking at a matter that says, or an assumption that says, our expenditure to the GDP is actually higher or is increasing, when in actual fact, it is because the economy is not growing at the right level. Because if it grows properly, your contribution, your expenditure will actually decrease. It's not an automatic thing, but it works like that. But what I'm saying is that I want to build an argument that in your presentation, the assumption of revenue collection growth vis-a-vis growth in the next MTF period does not necessarily follow. Because in your presentation, in your argument, in your model, you are not actually factoring the lag period in between.
because even growth itself does not necessarily suggest it will grow by 3%. Employment creation and employment absorption will be 3% immediately. There is that lag period in between the growth and the other factors of the economy. But the last point that I want to talk about what you said, the origin or the original conceptualization of a developmental state. I'm sure you'll agree with me, Jacques, that both countries or all the countries that have followed that model felt they had to adapt to their local conditions. But at the center, the state played a leading role. Japan and India, for instance, if you go to Japanese model of how the state used the developmental stage to move itself and to deal with the question of social inequalities, the state was at the center of development. So in, even in our case, I think that's where we're going. And there's no doubt about it. So that as we look at the medium-term budget policy statement, we should actually contextualize it within the challenges that the country faces, and therefore the ability of the state to respond and lead in particular aspects of actually improving the quality of life of our people, lives of our people. So I just wanted to make that input. You may disagree with me, but outside this forum, then we can take the debate.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, we could carry on with this debate. It was interesting to listen to our presenters, Professor Dwyer. Professor Dwyer is a professor in Holland. Many years ago, he wrote a book about the foundations of the state. And the basis of the state is a family, built on those building blocks. And the values of our constitution must be applied in our economy, because then we are working towards the betterment of the lives of families and individuals. And out of this deliberation, we listen to our presenters analyzing the road that was taken last week by the Minister of Finance. And most of us spend some time in the aircraft. When the pilot gets into his plane, he's got a flight plan. But when you fly over Kimberley, you hit a thunderstorm. And then you make a tactical adjustment to your plan to get around the thunderstorm. Now, this tactical adjustment was made to get around the downturn in the economy. How do we address it? And it was also said by doing things differently. And every one of us sitting here has got that responsibility to do things differently. Yesterday, I visited my constituency, and when the people look at you, you must look at their eyes, because they're looking for hope. And that's the reality. We can analyze here till kingdom comes, but when you address them, they want hope. And that's the point we must get at. The value for money, to do things differently, etc. To our presenters, thank you very much for your presentation. This committee will proceed tomorrow morning again at 9:30, I think in the same venue, you must please correct me. Chairperson, thank you also for your leadership. Co-chair Honorable Sigourney, and then our latest addition to the chairpersonship is Honorable Chani, elected last week as the chairperson of the Select Committee on Appropriation in the NCOP. Again, congratulations to you, Honorable Chani. Says with that word, we come to the end of this meeting. This meeting stands adjourned. Thank you. Good job, Chamber, tomorrow morning, 9:30.